Crime. I'm your host, Wesley Fox, loyal party member and editor of PressantSciFi.com. This is a special episode for two reasons. First, it is the 50th episode of Thought Crime. It's a nice big number. Not really time or date-wise, doesn't really mean anything else in any real particular way, but 50 is kind of like a big number we all like to celebrate. So this is the 50th episode. Doing this for about 19, 20 months now. We're approaching 2 years. Got quite a audience going here so far. It's a pretty modest audience, but whatever. I kind of do this for creative outlet, things like that. So I'm going to continue talking to myself and maybe occasionally try to get some guest hosts or guests on the show here as we go on. But after 50 shows, I got to tell you, I learned a lot from this experience, mostly about audio, but also about speaking, public speaking, and how often I say and in between words. I've been trying to work on that. I'm trying to make a point to get a little better about these things, and I'm kind of hoping that some of this stuff kind of works over to my day job and what I do in real life, but also just for your listening pleasure, that I sound a little bit better, and it's not as painful to listen to what I have to say. So I'd like to think after 50 episodes, I've gotten a little better, more insightful, and at least been informative in some way. So I think that is the direction I'm going to go with the show from now on. I'm going to try and be more informative, provide more information. There's plenty of fan podcasts out there, and everyone has their own opinion on movies, on books, TV shows, science fiction, whatever. So I'm going to try and bring a little bit more than just my opinion. My perspective, of course, I'm going to bring based on my background, whatever. But I'm going to try and dish out a little bit more knowledge and do some more research, more preparation, and kind of try to bring a little bit more with each show than just me sitting here talking about a movie I just saw or a TV show I just saw and how cool I think it is. So that is my plan for the next 50 shows. At 100, I guess I'll have to do something big. Hopefully by then I'm a huge superstar and everyone will know my name. And so at least that's the goal. I figure I can do that in 50 shows. I mean, it took me 50 shows to build an audience of squat to squat and half. So I figure at that pace I should be okay. So moving along. So anyway, yeah, episode 50. The second reason why this is a special episode is I'm taking a break from movies, TV, and things like that to talk about a book, one of my favorite novels of all time, a classic that's been around since, you know, it's around 67, 68 years old. It's been highly influential. It is arguably the greatest dystopian novel ever written, and that novel is George Orwell's 1984. And what brought this up is that I had to read it for book club. And I'm very glad I did, because I haven't read it in about 13 years. I read it in college for a course back when I was 19 or 20. It was like freshman, sophomore year. At that time, I thought I knew everything about politics, history, government, and philosophy. You know, nobody could really teach me anything. I thought 1984 was just one of those books that you had to read, and I would be able to, there's really nothing. I expected to learn a few things from it. I wasn't that arrogant. Close, but not quite. And anyway, I had kind of a view of the world and everything, and I kind of felt like there really wasn't, you know, a couple more years of college, a few things to fill in the gaps here and there in my knowledge and skills. And I figured I'd have everything set, and I would have learned everything I needed to know by the time I was 21 and graduating college. This book was one of several books that proved me wrong, that basically changed my worldview and deeply influenced me and still influences me to this day. In my opinion, every single human being should read 1984. Its insight, its depth, its themes, its just darkness, the nightmare it presents is something that I just don't think simply telling you like about political power, about surveillance and to read out of a textbook is one thing, but to demonstrate it, especially for us in the Western world, to demonstrate it in a story of what it's like to live in one of these kind of regimes, the way Russians had to live under it in the Soviet Union or Germans in Nazi Germany, because these are all variations of Orwell's Oceania Big Brother thing. I mean, Big Brother is kind of a dystopian 1980, you know, it's set in the future from when the book was written. And it's kind of taken, it's science fiction, it's set in the future, has some technologies that at the time did not exist. But basically, a lot of the things he discusses were at least in some part already a reality for a lot of people on Earth, and are still a reality for a lot of people to this day in China, North Korea, Vietnam, in any number of Arab countries, Iran, for example, that what it's like to live in that kind of nightmare society, nightmare world, and the fear and the pause and the kind of the way we all should in the Western world, in the free part of the free part of the world, we should all be vigilant about the things that creep on us, because Germany was a free country at one point before it became Nazi Germany. China was not a totalitarian state before the communists took over. These countries probably, and people in those societies, thought such things could never happen in their country until they happened. So 1984 is really a warning. It was meant as a warning in 1949 when it was published to England and to the broader Western world and the free world about the perils of totalitarianism and how it could happen and how it could happen, why it could happen. And really, that part of it influenced me a lot, of course, from a historical and political standpoint, but also some of the smaller themes that have to do with, you know, more about information, about privacy, the right to privacy, about language, about, you know, how we distract ourselves with booze and other things. I'll get into these a little later. But, I mean, it was just... this book just really has influenced my worldview since then, and is one of the big parts of... I mean, if anyone wanted to know anything about my worldview, and I'm sure there's all of one or two people out there on the planet, this book is one of the founding... texts of my worldview, this story, this novel. I mean, that's what it means to me. I believe everyone, like I said, everyone on the planet should read this book. So, glowing on that alone. But, and also, this is the first book I'm kind of, this is also the first time I think, I'll have to go back and check, that I'm discussing a classic work that's, you know, that far old. I usually talk about contemporary movies, TV. I will sometimes talk about certain books or novels that are a little bit more recent. I'll have to go back and check. I'm not sure I've done this before. But anyway, so I'm going to go through 1984, revisit it 68 years later. We're not quite to 70 years left, 70 years yet. So it's not quite a round number, you know, like episode 50. We're at 68 years. Maybe I should have waited 2 years, but I couldn't because I have just reread the book for my book club. And it's all fresh in my mind, and I was highlighting the book left and right. I have a paperback copy. This is one of the few times I've actually read a paperback. Most of the time I read ebooks for fiction, for novels. For nonfiction, I do paperback and hardcover, but, you know, whatever. You don't care about that. So, moving along. And, of course, as usual, I will tell you what I'm drinking. I'm, of course, sitting here having a beer. I'm having one from Natty Greens Brewing Company. It's based out of Greensboro, North Carolina. For those of you who do not know North Carolina geography, it is kind of dead set in the middle of the state, Greensboro is. It's about a city of, I think, 200,000, 150,000, 200,000. It's actually, it used to be kind of a, you could describe it as a rust belt, manufacturing and textiles and agriculture. Tobacco is big out there. Kind of an older economy kind of city, and, you know, classic southern city. In the last couple of decades, that has changed. Greensboro is actually a very nice city and has moved into the 21st century in most ways. It's definitely not, I mean, North Carolina in general is an awesome state. I recommend anyone to maybe forego Florida and actually come to North Carolina. If you want to go to the beaches, go to Wilmington. Or you can go down to Myrtle Beach or whatever. They're all kind of roughly in a pretty close to each other. We have mountains in Asheville in the west. We have cities. Charlotte, it's about 3-4 million people. The Raleigh-Durham area, which is where I reside, is three cities that add up to roughly 2.5 million, I think, 2.3, growing at about a clip of three or four hundred thousand people every decade. We're growing; it's a rapidly growing area. And Natty Green is one of the major breweries down here, and I think they distribute over a regional area. But anyway, the beer I have here is it's called Wildflower Wit Beer. Now, wit beers is more obviously. You can tell by the name, originates from Germany, and it's on the lighter side, of course. Wit, I think, it doesn't mean wheat. I think it refers to the combination of barley and wheat, and it's they tend to be a little bit on the lighter side. And this one is too. This is Wildflower Wit Beer. It's they describe it as refreshing and crisp, and I agree. This is kind of a summer beer. This is something you drink in warmer weather on the beach. It's got a little bit of like an orange peel, coriander, and chamomile. So it has a little bit of like a spice to it in addition to orange. It's not very sweet. It's got some sweetness to it, but not much. It's not very bitter. It's crisp at the end, but not too crisp. And it's not really that full-bodied. So you can drink a few of these and feel okay. It's also 4.5%, so this is not going to get you drunk that fast. So excellent beer. It's one of my new favorites down here. Highly recommend it. Natty Green's Wildflower Wit Beer. Okay, so we've done a layout of the show, the beer. Let's get started. All right, here's a quick summary for those of you who did not read or don't remember much about this novel, did not read it in college or high school, and maybe don't know. So really quickly, just some basic kind of raw statistics or basics on the novel. It was written by George Orwell, a British writer who had grown up living all over the world, India. I think he was born in India, actually. He was in Spain during the Spanish Civil War, just before World War II. Then he came back to England, and kind of the things he saw in the colonial experience, the fascism in Spain, he witnessed the rise of Nazi Germany, of communism, the Soviet Union. I mean, this all happened in his lifetime in the 30s and 20s, 30s, and 40s. So he was deeply informed and shaped by the events of the first part of the 20th century. And he began as a socialist of sorts. He was more on the left than the right, so to speak. But he got to see firsthand kind of the ugly, ugly side of the far left and the far right. And I think it kind of moderated him a little bit, but he was more concerned with the extremes, and particularly power concentrated in a totalitarian full state. And that's kind of what influenced his writing. The first book that everyone will probably know him from is Animal Farm, about all those cute animals that take over a farm, and it's basically a critique and a commentary on communism and socialism. I mean, he was a deep critic of actually socialism. Although he was on the left, he was not. He kind of moved away from kind of a full socialist ideology. He kind of, like I said, he moved away from the extremes, far left, far right, and he wanted some moderation. And he kind of was more worried about the fear of going too far. And I think Animal Farm was more about communism and more about the Soviet Union and something aimed at a lot of the people in England at the time that thought the Soviet Union had the right idea and wanted to emulate it in England. And I think that also is what fed his view when he wrote 1984. He wrote 1984 right after World War II. So Nazi Germany is gone, fascist Italy is gone, Japan is gone, the Soviet Union is now the other major world power. He got to see the very beginning of the Cold War. He passed away, I think, in 1950 or 1949, so he really did not get to see much of what his book did, 1984 did. So it was, but he was at the height of his popularity, so to speak. So, but he saw all that, and he wanted to create, and this story, I think, was kind of a warning that a lot of the evils that were defeated in World War II there's still worries about it. He could see some of those instincts in his own people, in England, a free country, a democratic society. And he kind of wanted to create this nightmare scenario of 1984 when English socialism, or communism basically, takes over and pulls what is a free country into the nightmare, and then depict the nightmare in its totality, because most English did not know what it was like to live in the Soviet Union or to live in that. And that's true now of Americans who, especially younger ones, that have no memory of the Soviet Union, of communism. They're not taught it. Colleges tend to gloss over much of the my college did not do this too much, but they did tend to lighten up on the nightmares and the brutality of the Soviet Union, and they like to focus more on what America has been doing and the West has been doing, and they kind of more focus on that. They tended to see communism as something that was gone. It had been gone for 10 years when I was in college, or 12 years, and they didn't really want to talk about it. But the idea, some of the ideas, like of socialism, most of them were very sympathetic. Some of them were socialists, and they just did not want to talk about the examples, the historical examples, in particular the Soviet Union, of the dark side of it. So we still now, like, even just as England in the post World War II era, when Soviet Union, who were the allies of the British in World War II, some people in England thought that the Soviet Union was the future, the communism was the future, that was the way to go, and that the Great Depression was proof that capitalism was a failed system, and yada yada yada. So that long history lesson, just to give you an idea of where the book comes from, where Orwell was coming from in terms of his experience, and where the book is. And the book, I think, was meant as a warning to the far to the left of England, to keep it, to keep a lot of the principles of the Enlightenment and of the British state, and to not go too far, to go to the extreme left, and to go nuts. And that's what the book is about. And I think it does it beautifully. It does it better than almost any other novel. The only one I think that could really get close to it is his other book, Animal Farm. I mean, they're both amazing. It is if you classify it, it is obviously a dystopian novel. It's arguably, 1984 is arguably one of the best, is the best dystopian novel ever written. I'd argue it is, but I know there's other people that have favorites like Brave New World and a few others. So it's not the undisputed, as with most things in literature and entertainment and things like that, very few things are undisputed, or, you know, there's hardly ever consensus on what's the best, what's, you know, whatever. But to me, 1984, if it's not number one, it's number two or number three. And most people would tend to agree with that assessment. First thing I want to talk about with 1984 is its explanation of a totalitarian state's view on political power. Most younger people, millennials, I mean, actually probably just about everyone these days, are pretty cynical about government's, you know, pursuit of power, things like that. Usually power for their own ends. I mean, it's nice to be principled and ideology, but I mean, there's many of us are cynics. So a lot of the things in this book probably wouldn't surprise, that part of this book probably wouldn't surprise readers today too much, except to say that it was taking an ideology from the left, far leftist standpoint, and kind of exposing it for what it is to people that just refuse to believe it. So if you're a socialist or somebody who leans, you know, pretty far left economically, politically, Orwell was kind of pointing at you and say, look, this is kind of the end result of this kind of path. The Soviet Union is case in point. And then most of the 20th century is loaded with examples of going too far and creating these nightmares. And these nightmares exist because the government does not care about economic prosperity, equality, the people, bringing justice to the proletariat and breaking down, you know, the social hierarchies. They don't care about that. As the character O'Brien, and really quickly, I'll go, in case you haven't read it in a while, the main character is Winston Smith. He is the guy working for the Ministry of Truth, which is kind of a propaganda arm of the party, or Big Brother. Him and his girlfriend, Julia, fall in love and decide they want to be part of the resistance movement, the shadowy kind of entity called the Brotherhood. They're captured by O'Brien, who Winston thought was a like-minded person who also worked in the Ministry of Truth. He thought that this guy was O'Brien was part of the Brotherhood. Turns out O'Brien was part of the Thought Police and captured him and brought him in. And so during his interrogations and during the torture that takes place at the end of the book, which is just a wonderful, wonderful experience to read. It's freaking awful. Anyway, O'Brien tells him, he asks him, what do you think is the goal of Big Brother? And Winston thinks, you know, to give the right answers, to say, you know, the equality and, you know, to better the plight of the people, you know, so that everyone is better off than they were under the old unfair capitalist system. And O'Brien just says, no, the pursuit of the only goal of the party is power. Power for its own end, nothing else. The party does not care about prosperity, happiness, scientific advancement, social progress. Nothing matters. Now, the perception of pursuing these things is important, which is why they have a Ministry of Truth. But the reality is they don't care. They don't care about science. They don't care about these things. All they care about is their own power and to secure kind of their position, which, you know, isn't lavish, you know, like the old capitalists were, but it's better than the regular people. The inner party is lives are much more comfortable and better than the outer party and the proles, the proletariat, and the rest of the common folk. But that's all they want. Everything they do is for that. They don't really care about anything else. And he kind of drops that on Winston as, that's what it is, that's what we want, this is what we're doing here. And it's going to succeed. The party is going to succeed forever, because they've mastered the means of protecting power and pursuing it to a level that no previous tyranny or oppressive government has been able to do. And the reason is technology and the ability to monitor and surveil the entire country. That technology had only recently been invented through a device called the telescreen, which is basically a smart TV. That can both send messages and receive messages. But that's his gist, is that we are just like every other power seeking tyrant or faction. It's just that we have the means to actually put it in place and keep it in place and not have to run on this treadmill of bringing economic prosperity to the people, keeping them content, keeping society stable or happy. We don't have to make any progress. We basically are in a position where we control all information, control language, control everyone's thought and movement, to the point where we no longer need to satisfy anyone but ourselves. He also, in another interesting part in the discussion of political power, is mentioned in Goldstein's book. Now, Goldstein is he's like the Leon Trotsky of the party. He was cast out by Big Brother for being a counter-revolutionary. So now he's considered this kind of counter-revolutionary, maybe even the leader of the Brotherhood. Nobody really knows. Winston gets a hold of his pamphlet or his book, you know, where he details his ideology and everything wrong with the party. And one of the points he makes is a revolution, a dictatorship is not... All right. One of the lines is, you have a revolution to establish a dictatorship, not the other way around. So in other words, there's not really a revolution against a dictatorship to overthrow a dictatorship. He said, that's not how it works. Revolutions establish dictatorships. Historically, that's what happened in Russia. The Russian Revolution was about equality, fraternity, you know, overthrowing the Tsar, overthrowing oppression, overthrowing, you know, absolute rule. What replaced it? Basically, a totalitarian communist version of the same thing. The revolution was there to establish a true dictatorship, stronger than the Tsar, better than the Tsar. And there's other examples, too, of revolutions that began with these high principles and ideals, and they get hijacked by a small faction or party that uses it as a vehicle to put themselves in power. In Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood basically hijacked the Tahrir Square revolution against President Mubarak. The revolution was largely about removing Mubarak from power and trying to break the police state that existed in Egypt under Mubarak. and to, you know, more liberty, more political parties, more freedom, you know, mostly just kind of a liberal revolution, not really a full liberal transformation, but something that would move them in the direction towards being a freer country instead of a one-party state, police state, run by Mubarak. Well, the Muslim Brotherhood basically took over, and once they were in power, they started instituting a lot of the same basic mechanisms and things that Mubarak had, except for them, it was to serve the Brotherhood and their radical Islamic ideology, or whatever you want to call it. Basically, they were fundamentalists. Well, at least luckily for Egypt, Muslim Brotherhood did not stay in power long. The military retook power, and basically Egypt is back to where it started, just with a president with a different name. And let's go through all the Arab Spring states, just more recent examples of revolutions that start off with a lot of liberal ideals about freedom, democracy, and the people, you know, popular uprisings, and they end badly. They end with more newer dictatorships or chaos. Libya overthrew Gaddafi. Libya is a failed state. Syria, failed state in their attempt to overthrow Assad. Iraq, we helped them. We went in there and removed Saddam Hussein and tried to build a new, free, democratic government. The results kind of speak for themselves. They do still have a Republican form of government. They do have more freedom now than they did under Saddam in a few areas, but in a lot of ways, Iraq is not a free country and is not a prosperous country at all. Some are doing very well in Iraq. The Kurds, many of the Kurds have the Kurdish region has kind of had this renaissance of sorts, modernization, yada, yada. Anyway, the point is the Iraqi kind of transition did not happen the way people thought it would. And it's been a lot messier and uglier, and the results have just not really stood up. The popular uprisings in Yemen and Bahrain failed. Yemen's a failed state now. The popular uprising in Iran failed. So the Arab Spring really did not bring much more freedom. The only counterexample I can think of is Tunisia. Its freely elected government is still in place. It's fragile, but it is still in place. And there's really been no move on the part of the new Tunisian government to reestablish some sort of new dictatorship. So actually, Tunisia, at least for now, has hope of actually fulfilling the lofty ideals and aims of the revolution that happened there. But that, I mean, and that's just the Arab Spring. That's the most recent example. I mean, that's what's happened in the last 10, 15 years. So I think it's fresher in people's minds. I could go further back into other revolutions in the 20th and 19th century of basically starting off as a popular uprising in having, you know, these big ideals and ending in just more nightmares, more failure. So that kind of part of Goldstein's novel, Goldstein's book, and also the message in the 1984 novel about what happened in England, the Ingsoc Revolution, the English Socialist Revolution that happened in the 40s and 50s, that these kind of revolutions that start, you know, with these ideals could end in dictatorship, and that's exactly what happens most of the time. The other interesting thing that Goldstein points out about the party, and O'Brien confirms it later on during his torture sessions with Winston, is that the war that Oceania, and there's three superstates, Oceania, East Asia, and Eurasia. That's what the world is now in 1984. That Oceania fights these wars not really as a means of conquering these other two states. What they're actually doing is they're using the surplus production that the Industrial Revolution has brought. And instead of trying to find a way to equally distribute it, these new things and rising everyone up, they decide we can't really do that. We would rather just burn away the extra consumables, and then that way we have an excuse for not providing them to the rest of the people. They feel like providing the surplus would destabilize the society because they would not be equally distributed. They don't want to equally distribute them. They'd rather keep everyone poor at the same level and use the excess, you know, surplus kind of production just to build a war machine and just fight these wars where they're not trying to conquer anyone. They're just trying to fight a war. And today, most of us probably are familiar with this in the sense that we feel like wars are used to help a president, you know, gather the country and patriotism and nationalism around an enemy, and they rally around the president, and he's politically the most powerful he's ever been. George Bush's approval ratings went to 75, 80, 85% after 9/11, and his strike against Afghanistan and Iraq afterwards were actually very popular for the first couple of years of his of the war on terror, and then the popularity fell apart as we found no WMDs and our post-war plan for Iraq. Well, we found out there was really no post-war plan for Iraq. But we're kind of familiar with that. We're kind of familiar of governments and presidents in particular using wars as a way of protecting themselves and rallying the country around them and kind of distracting them from their other weaknesses and incompetencies and doing their job. It's also, I mean, so the way of, you know, skimming off surplus production, doesn't make a lot of sense to me. That I'm not sure. I think maybe that was kind of an idea in the 40s. I'm not sure if people really buy that now. I think people more see it as a way of distracting the populace from domestic problems. And this kind of, you know, fighting these wars with these two other superpowers, you know, without actually conquering them, and there's almost like this stability of the three. They fight wars all the time. They're all three of them are trying to do the same thing. They're all three of them have the same systems inside. They're all totalitarian. They're able to do this without really threatening one another, thanks to nuclear weapons. And Orwell recognized that right away, the mutually assured destruction. In the novel, he talks about an atomic war that took place in the 50s. And after all these cities were annihilated, everyone just realized, like, all right, we can't fight wars like this, but we do need war for these to serve our own political ends domestically. So we fight these wars in these far-off places away from our capitals, like in India, in the Congo jungles, and in the Pacific. And I think we all can kind of relate to that now, because we kind of feel that these wars that the U.S. has gotten involved in, or Europe, you know, they're always off in these distant places in countries that we can barely find on a map. We can't even spell. And, you know, this is kind of something that we can all kind of relate to here in a way. And he wrote about this in 1949. It really was an amazing insight. All right, time to talk about the science fiction element to this novel. Dystopian novels, generally, I would put under science fiction for a number of reasons that I won't get into now, but some of them are just dystopias with no technological or futuristic element to it. Well, this one does. It takes place 35 years after the publication date of 1949. So 1984 for Orwell was 35 years in the future. He imagined that Oceania and Big Brother and this totalitarian state, this level of oppression, is made possible by new technologies. And in particular, a technology and a device called a telescreen. Telescreen is basically, it's a communications device, basically a television that both transmits and receives. So a telescreen has a camera on it. It's basically like a laptop, a computer with the camera on top, except the camera on top is always on and somebody is watching you at all times. And you cannot turn it off and you cannot destroy it. You're required to have a telescreen in your house, maybe even two or three, you know, depending, so that they can cover most of your house. And, of course, the mics, the listening devices, the computers that can go through all this and find you. So there's a number of, like, things here. So basically what O'Brien kind of explains is that the reason that Big Brother is just a new kind of superpower is because for the first time in history, we are able to actually have surveillance over the entire country at all times. That's never been done before. Everyone before them would like to do that. The Nazis would have liked to do that. The Romans, the Holy Roman Empire, the Byzantinians, the Caliphate from the Muslim conquest. I mean, you name any tyrant, any oppressive regime throughout the world, throughout history, and O'Brien explains this, they all would love to do, they're all doing the same thing, except they don't have the means to monitor their people and identify threats and identify dissent, and to keep them in line and to influence them and to re-educate them and brainwash them the way that Big Brother can, thanks to telescreens and a number of other these new innovations of the 20th century. It's terrifying. This was written in 1949, and we now have telescreens. We call them smart TVs, or we call them computers or laptops with the camera on top. We would like to believe that those cameras are for us and nobody's watching. But stories have popped up in the last few years of hackers that can activate the camera on your computer without the light going on and can watch whatever's going on. The government, I'm sure, and if a hacker can figure that out, a government certainly can. And now we have algorithms and computer programs that can look for, you know, look for buzzwords, look for certain identifiers. We have facial recognition. We have all these additional capabilities thanks to the internet and software that Orwell may have imagined but could not put into words and could not describe. But we today are familiar with them because we use them. It is the technology and the software that goes into the search engines of Google and Bing. It is how Netflix makes recommendations or Amazon makes recommendations for us. It's like they know what we want before we know it. All of these things are real today in 2017. They're real. The surveillance technology necessary for Big Brother exists, and it is accessible to the government. Now, so far, the government has only slowly and gradually utilized these technologies. We now have more. We have closed circuit TVs all over cities. We're increasing, you know, the biometrics. We have these security checkpoints at airports and things like that. So they're slowly moving in that direction, and they're using more and more of these new fresh technologies to monitor us to a much greater degree than they ever have before. But as for the smart TVs and all the other monitoring and everything else, ironically, we're kind of doing it to ourselves. Nobody is forcing you to use Facebook. Nobody's forcing you to go on Snapchat or to use the GPS in your phone. In fact, nobody's forcing you to buy a cell phone. Of course, most of us would say you can't really work or live in the United States without a cell phone. But really, we are the ones, we're buying these devices. We are putting tracking devices on ourselves. We're putting microphones next to ourselves. We're putting cameras in our own faces. It's really quite stunning. We're doing this to ourselves. And we're comfortable with it because we're choosing to do it. And the companies and the entities behind these technologies are private corporations. They're not the government. So we kind of talk about, you know, Big Brother. Everyone knows what Big Brother means, even if they haven't read the book 1984, or they haven't read it in years, and they didn't understand it. Everyone knows what Big Brother means. I mean, there's a TV show on CBS called Big Brother, and the premise is obviously, on its face, understands the point. It's all about surveillance. We kind of joke about, you know, we all kind of nod our heads and kind of say, yeah, it is kind of, you know, exciting and terrifying at the same time, you know, what these technologies can do and what these companies and what the government is increasing capability can do. But then we just kind of shrug it off and don't really do anything about it. We're all worried about it, but nobody really changes their habits. I should caution that a little bit. Generally, we're not changing our habits. A lot of people are trying to disengage from social media, and they're trying to be a lot more careful about their internet virtual footprint. So there are some people concerned enough to change their habits, but a lot of people just don't. And we don't seem to be that worried about, because in the last election, we elected a number of representatives, Congress, and a president that have no interest in doing anything about the expanding surveillance state, the Edward Snowden files, you know, the NSA. We caused an uproar for a few weeks and a few months, and, you know, town hall meetings and newscasters, we all talked about it for a while, and then we just elected the same group of people that put those programs in and have done virtually nothing, and have only done maybe a handful of minor tweaks around the corners to keep the federal government in check in terms of using these technologies against us. We are not electing anyone, and we're not raising hell to dismantle these programs or to dismantle these technologies or to pull them back or to put stronger restrictions on the use of these things and the right to privacy, yada, 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 civil liberties. Some people are concerned about it and are electing officials, but as a country, as an electorate, and that's what I mean. I'm making a generalization as an electorate because we just had an election. And you got this, and you got the general sense that those issues, this issue in particular, did not really concern us. I'm going to get political for a little bit, and then I'll move on to things that are not too close to home. But basically, They ask voters what influenced their vote, what issues they cared about the most. And most of the time it was economics, immigration, a little bit of foreign policy, a little bit of civil liberties here and there, and a bunch of other minor issues sprinkled in. Trump voters generally were concerned with foreigners and trade and some cultural things about transgender bathrooms and those are the things that seem to galvanize them the most. You know, those Chinese are taking our jobs, those Mexicans are crossing the border and taking our jobs and committing crimes, and Europe is not paying its fair share. And so those were the things that were worried about them the most. Nobody who voted on that side really had any concern about the NSA, the Justice Department, or anything else, except to say that the Justice Department should have indicted Hillary. That was their big thing. On the other side, Hillary Clinton has never, never raised a finger or done anything either as a senator or as a candidate to show any real seriousness about federal police power. Never. In fact, she seems to benefit from it. She's more of a hawk. She was more of a hawk when she was in the Senate, and her speeches and everything seem to suggest that she's more of that ilk than she is of like a Dennis Kucinich or somebody who thinks that we do way too much in the world, we should withdraw. Yeah, you know, or Obama in 2008, who promised to get us out of Iraq and Afghanistan. Those were the two candidates that were nominated. Granted, both were very unpopular, but a lot of the congressmen, senators, I mean, you can go back and forth. Just to sum up, as an electorate, we seem to be largely distracted from this issue. And combine that with the fact that a lot of the surveillance we are voluntarily doing to ourselves and making available to everyone, I mean, that concerns me and worries me about the future. And I think 1984 is instructive, and that's why I think everyone should read it, and especially millennials who have no memory of communism and are probably not being really taught it that much in universities, because universities generally don't want to show that side of socialism or communism or whatever. I went to college. I know, you know, and I've heard plenty of people in my generation that all said the same thing. Professors and they just don't like to do that because they still, some of the core, like pure ideals of socialism, they still agree with and think can be implemented without turning into Big Brother. So they won't show you that side. So that's why. Another thing about the surveillance state that didn't involve technology was the use of children. Big Brother would take your children, put them in these education camps, and turn them into spies, and encourage them to listen to their parents, listen to their neighbors, and to rat on them if they start saying anything against the party or Big Brother, anything subversive. And I think Winston said it in part of the novel, it was very common for people to fear their own children. I mean, that also is, there's a kernel of truth to that in Russia, in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union tried to do that as well. And I think a few other totalitarian states have done the same thing. Offhand, I can't think of other examples and can't tell, but I do remember reading about a few of those things in the Soviet Union, at least. I don't know how successful or how widespread they were, but they do exist. They did exist. And all of this, I mean, of course, you just combine the fear factor of this surveillance, fearing your children, fearing that you're being watched. And if you say the wrong thing, you will be imprisoned, killed, your family will be killed, that your neighbors, if your neighbors don't turn you in, they could be brought in and imprisoned as well. So they have an incentive to actually turn you in, or even if they don't really know, even if they just might have heard something or misheard you, they are terrified of being dragged into it, so they would rather turn on you. So this turns neighbors against each other, it turns parents against children, you know, family members against one another. This is all about turning everything in the state, within a country, into Mike's monitorization and surveillance. It's horrifying, and it requires the total obliteration of the right to privacy, in addition to virtually every other constitutional and civil liberty that we in America learn about in high school and college, but often do not fully understand, appreciate, and we almost always take for granted. The next part, all right, so I've talked about the power politics, the surveillance state. Those are the two most obvious kind of things that usually courses will cover. Courses will also cover this part, and I think moving away from like the political science part of it, more towards like the history, psychology, sociology, and those things, and communications, turning to how Big Brother and the party tried to reshape human nature. And they felt they could. In fact, O'Brien says they believe man is malleable, infinitely malleable. We can reshape, if we have the ability, the power, and we have the institutions in place, we can reshape them. Nobody before could, or at least they could, but not to the level that Big Brother can. So they're going to reshape human nature. And how do they do it? They dismantle all other civil, political, and social institutions that exist in any country. Churches, gone. Political parties, of course, are gone. Any kind of civil groups, social groups, you know, gatherings. Anything. Schools. Everything is annihilated and replaced with party infrastructure and apparatus. And this all comes from INGSOC, or English socialism. And they just call it INGSOC because in Newspeak they like to shorten things. So they have to turn everything into an arm of the party, a subsidiary of the party. Everything else that you knew had to be destroyed, and any talking about it was considered evil. It was all criminalized, to be hated, sinister. You know, those churches are, you know, they're just molesting boys and they just care about controlling sex. These other parties are actually counter-revolutionaries. They work for those damn capitalists. They're just trying to screw you. I mean, they just turn everyone else but the party into the worst enemies ever. And then they take over every aspect of life. In the book, the party has to approve marriages. Hooking up with people is, if you're a party member, hooking up, you know, casual relationships are forbidden, basically. You can be arrested for them. In fact, at one point, and it goes so far, as O'Brien even says, we will abolish the orgasm. He thinks they'll have the ability to control sex and take away the sex drive from humanity. That's how malleable he thinks it's possible. And if you read the book, you can see a little bit of what Big Brother's already doing to control the sex drive of men in particular, but everyone in general. It's really amazing, and some of it comes from truth and things that certain governments and institutions have tried to do in the past, but of course it's taken to a greater degree because this is a dystopia. But they have to eliminate all the other things that men are passionate about or humans are passionate about. They want you to only be passionate about them, the party, and nothing else. They can't have you falling in love, because then you might kill for that woman or kill for that man because you love them. They don't want you to be loyal or compassionate or attached to anyone or any family. That's why they abolish families in general. They can't have you part of an institution, part of a club, part of a religion. You can't have any of that, any loyalties, any connection, attachment. They have to annihilate. The only attachment you're allowed to have is to the party. It's really, it feels like it shouldn't be possible. And I don't really agree that man is infinitely malleable, as O'Brien says, but people are malleable to some extent. And if the government had access to the tools that Big Brother has access to, or the tools we have today, and had any competency, they could reshape a society over time, generations. Even O'Brien admits it takes generations. You can't just do it. I mean, some people, they're just, if they remember the old ways or the old country, or they remember how things were before the revolution, they're beyond hope, but the children aren't. And so it kind of takes a couple generations. And of course, they have to refine their technique and things like that. O'Brien goes over all of this. But they feel like they can reshape their society and human nature all the way down to the individual and what goes on between their ears. It's horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying, because the tactics that O'Brien talks about of how they reshape people are done today. Not to the extreme level, but are done. And governments have tried them. Companies have tried them, religions have tried them. These are all ways to try and reshape society and reshape individuals to be more compliant. One way, and the big way that I feel the most horrified by, is the creation of a new language called Newspeak. It's taking the English language and shrinking it down from, you know, millions of words down to a very, very small vocabulary, a very small dictionary, and shortening words to like portmanteaus, like English socialism becomes INGSOC, things like that. And instead of saying something is great or something is awesome, you say double plus good. And I think one of the characters talks to Winston and he says, why should we have words that are like negative words? Like to say something is bad or evil. The negative of a word is in the word itself. The word contains its own opposite. So negative good or minus good or, you know, something like that. I forget what the exact example is. But they narrow the language down. That discourages rational thought, discourages logic and reason, and kind of hides the contradictions, the inconsistencies, and makes and just discourages people from thinking. You know, simplify communications to something so basic that it's very difficult to start having more abstract thoughts. In fact, any kind of words that lend themselves to abstract thought are eliminated. Maybe some of you know where I'm going with this, but basically that's how I see what we're doing with the English language in America. We're doing it voluntarily. We're doing it to ourselves. Our command of the English language as a whole is getting gradually worse. We're still literate, but we're not far above the basic literacy level. Previous generations, when they were educated, had a much better command of the English language. Not everyone, of course, it was unequal. But we as a whole, we have literacy rates that are insanely high, 98, 99, 97%. You'd think that we would be getting better at this. We're not. We text. We shorten words. We don't even speak in complete sentences. We don't write in complete sentences. Most students struggle in English composition, whether in high school or in college. They're getting worse at it. Our vocabularies are getting gradually smaller. Popular culture has dumbed things down to the most just trite of words and thoughts and things. We use so much slang now. We use so much slang and idioms and things like that that basically are catch-alls that can mean any number of things. We use words for three or four different meanings, even when the meanings are contradictory or they don't really fit. Like the word selfie. I've heard people call any picture of themselves a selfie, even if they didn't take the picture. A backlash against people who are trying to encourage the proper use of language. We call them grammar Nazis. But there's a reason that, at least there's a good reason to try and be precise in your language, especially when it's serious. Not when you're out at the bar with your friends. But if in business and in communications with family and friends, there is a lot to be said about using the right words, using the right, conveying ideas clearly, which might mean using some big words or using some obscure words and using sentences properly. What's the biggest problem that leads to divorce? What do the surveys say? Lack of communication. Now, that's a loaded thing. It's not just about words and vocabulary, but I mean, I think that a lot of what goes wrong in basic human interaction nowadays has to do with the fact that our ability to communicate with one another is slowly degrading. We're not as good at this as we used to be. And we're not illiterate, we're not stupid, and we're not just, you know, cavemen, ooga aga, but there's been a move in the wrong direction. And again, like I just said with the surveillance state, we're doing this to ourselves. The government isn't doing this to us. They're not making us stupid. Although you could argue that the decrease in quality of public schools might have something to do with it, but we're really doing this to ourselves as adults. I mean, we just don't care as a whole. We just don't. Like, we don't consider this really a priority. We consider foreigners, foreign policy, and wars and things like that, and bathrooms, you know, and using the right word, the right pronoun. Those are the things that seem to die. Or, you know, celebrity breakups or celebrity marriages or athletes talking trash about one another. These are the top searches on search engines. These are the things that get the most hits on the internet. And these are the things most talked about at water coolers, at offices. We're doing this to ourselves. We're basically moving towards newspeak on our own. We didn't need Big Brother to do it to us. And it's emojis. I mean, that's the other thing. Emojis, they're not even words. People want to communicate in symbols now. Basic symbols. I mean, that's ugh. Now, why shrink the language? Why is Big Brother doing it? Why would the government care about vocabulary? Well, like I said, they want to make abstract thought, higher forms of thought, logic and reason, more difficult. they want to make people more and more dependent on what they're told, and to keep their communication simplified and keep their thought process simplified to the point where they make a thought crime literally impossible. That's Big Brother's objective, or the Ministry of Truth's objective in creating Newspeak. And as you notice, this podcast takes its name from 1984 and the concept of a thought crime. Basically, any thought that is contrary to the party. You don't even need to say it. You just have to think it. And they're able to figure out what you're thinking just by watching you, even if you never say it. O'Brien tells Winston they had been watching him for years, and he had never uttered a word about rebellion or defiance or subversiveness until the last few months, until the last month or two before he was arrested. And yet they said they were on to him for years. They knew he was going to be a problem because they knew he was starting to have subversive thoughts. The look in his eye, during the patriotic songs, he wasn't quite enthusiastic enough. I mean, they picked up on his patterns, his body language, his work. I mean, this is what algorithms could do on the internet to find people's predispositions. You could identify, or the pictures they put up, or the memes they use. I mean, again, we're basically giving them all the evidence they need to do these kind of things and identify thought crimes if they wanted to. And that's really, it's a something that I am terrified of, and I really think that we seem to be okay with the idea of thought crimes. We think there's when somebody thinks something that is offensive or politically incorrect, we think people should be punished, even if they haven't acted on it. Even if we can't even prove they thought it. We just kind of, he clearly meant that as a racist slur. As if we know. I mean, that's what commentators on television do with politicians, celebrities, et cetera, et cetera. They try to get into their minds and say, what he actually meant was this. I don't care what he says in his press statement the next day. He really meant this because he's a racist. How do we know that? We crawling in his head? I mean, we don't, and we're okay accusing people of these things. We are okay with it now. We don't need evidence anymore. We don't need proof. We don't need action. We're willing to condemn one another. And I mean this all directions, left, right, up, down, conservative, liberal, black, white, man, woman, transgender, LGBT, whatever. We're more than happy to accuse each other of thought crimes today. And it is chilling. It chills discourse. People cannot have civil discussions about a lot of issues anymore. We're so hammered by it, by the bipolar nature of the politics. We all kind of look at each other we're all afraid of saying the wrong thing. We don't know what word is going to set somebody off, and we can't use that word anymore. We can't say that anymore. Oh, that phrase isn't good anymore. Or that metaphor, that analogy. Or this one's okay, but that one's not, and we're coming. I mean, it's not to say that we should abandon these kind of social justice and all these other programs that, or crusades or whatever you want to call movements, these things about progressivism to change our society. The thing that I'm referring to specifically is to point at somebody and accuse them of being sexist, racist, not by what they've done. And not even by what they said, because what they said could be interpreted any number of ways, and you've chosen to interpret it in the way that is offensive. We do that to each other all the time now, and it is really, really disturbing, and it's chilling. And it is something that is touched on in 1984, when, in the novel at least, it's the government that is trying to transform language and is using, and the thought crime is anything against the party. But we all seem to think, and I think we won't say the word. Nobody will ever say the word. But if you were to ask somebody a few questions about what they feel is good or bad or should be is morally wrong or maybe even criminal, I think a growing number of people would actually agree that there is such thing as a thought crime. It really is just bizarre. And I don't see any way. I don't know if the government ever tries to do it. I don't know. I mean, that's different. I mean, that's what 1984 is about. You know, just, you know, civil society, you know, people talking to one another, celebrities, you know, what we do within ourselves without the state. We're doing it to ourselves gradually and more. And so we don't even need the state to do it to us. We're doing it to ourselves. So in 1984, it's the state. It's the government that is doing it. I think today although I would say the government is certainly guilty of some of these practices to a certain degree, I think a lot of it, we seem to be just doing it to ourselves, and we're not willing to do anything to reverse course, change course, or change our habits or ways. We kind of talk about it. We say, oh, yeah, it's very troubling that listening to phone calls, the NSA is listening to my phone calls, yada. And then we don't do anything about it. We don't change our voting habits. We don't call congressmen. We don't do anything. Very few of us do. I mean, I know some do. I'm not saying all of us. What I'm saying is, as an electorate, we don't. So the other goal of reshaping language and reshaping human nature is to make everyone possible of doublethink. Doublethink is the ability to hold two ideas and believe in two ideas that are contradictory to one another. And there's about 7 or 8 examples of doublethink in the novel, one of them being that they were at war with Eurasia for years and years and years. They'd always been at war with Eurasia. And then in the middle of a speech, the guy comes out and says they're at war with East Asia, and they've been at war with East Asia forever. Now, that wasn't simultaneous to the extent of, but some people would say that, oh, we've always been at war at East Asia. What do you mean? We just earlier today, we're at war with Eurasia. Like, the posters were on the walls about Eurasia, about the war against Eurasia, all the propaganda posters. They tore them all down and put new ones up. Or other kind of concepts of marriage, of sex, of these anti-sex leagues, and then being okay with creating porn for the proletariat class and allowing them to do whatever they want, having hookers and prostitutes and whatever. Like, there's just all sorts of these weird things where, and the ultimate goal, and like I said, is to destroy reason and logic and to make sure humans don't have those kind of abilities and don't think that way. They don't want humanity to use reason, because they don't want them to pursue anything. They want them to need Big Brother and to have Big Brother provide and not think about it and not worry about it. And don't, thinking is for nerds. You know, that's probably one of the things they might use if it was America, you know. Stop being a nerd. Don't worry about it. Have another beer, you know. Watch some more porn, free porn on the internet. You know, I'll get to that one in a little bit, but I'm starting to get ahead of myself. But the idea of a double thing, actually, we're already capable of it now. I mean, in the polls and surveys that Gallup and Pew and these other groups, they'll ask people a set of questions, and you will see people give contradictory answers about economics, about society. I mean, you will see them answer one way in one question and answer totally different with two ideas that are contradictory. We usually call it cognitive dissonance. But doublethink is just another structured way of saying cognitive dissonance. We're all guilty. I mean, we're all capable of it. And we all do it, you know, here and there on the edges of our minds. So, and some people, you know, we call, some of it comes from denial. Some of it comes from us gradually, you know, changing our views, but not changing them fully all at once. So, you know, half of our view is one way, half is the other, because we're still kind of transitioning, we're growing up. And so it's possible to hold contradictory views on things or ideas on things because you haven't fully thought things through and abandoned maybe some of your younger, you know, your younger self, your older ideas. To make everyone capable of it to a high degree, everyone, you know, to the point where even the smartest people and everyone is capable of doublethink and it's commonplace, is the goal of Big Brother. Because they believe men are infinitely malleable. And to do that is the ultimate way of making sure that they can just tell them we're at war with one country one day, and then we're at war with another country the next day, and that we've always been at war with them. Or tell them that we actually hit our quota of, you know, 20 million tractors or 20 million, you know, bushels of grain, when actually 6 months ago the news said that the goal was 40 million. I mean, they do that all the time. I mean, that was Winston's job. He was rewriting history, rewriting government reports and press releases to make sure they fit with what actually happened later on, so that Big Brother is never wrong. So if he said a year ago that we're going to produce 20 million bushels of hay and or grain, and they only made 10 million, he'll go back and switch Big Brother's prediction to 10 million from a year ago to make sure it matches up. As humans, in our personal lives, rewrite our own histories all the time. We try not to. We like to say that we're consistent, admit our mistakes, yada, yada. But we all know people that rewrite history and reimagine things or tell stories that make them look better or make them look sympathetic and make somebody else look bad. Rewriting history to an extreme level, as what Big Brother does, is different. That's even in our personal lives, 99.9% of us would have trouble doing that. And we wouldn't get away with it, one. And two, we just couldn't do it with a straight face. But the point being that if you control the past, you control the prior record, you can make yourself right about anything. You can provide evidence of whatever argument you want to make, and you will win because you basically manufactured the evidence. And O'Brien and the big line from 1984 about this, about the government using this method, is he who controls the present controls the past. Basically meaning that if you are in power, you have a means of rewriting history to serve yourself. And we actually have some other ideas of this already. We already say, like, history is written by the victors. Obviously, the winners of wars will tend to teach people about that war, making them look like the righteous side and that they defeated evil. I mean, we're all familiar with that. Those are all kind of low-level kind of rewriting of history, of kind of massaging the facts and spin. That's everyone's guilty of spin. Every political party, every politician, every government, they all spin. And individuals, we all spin. To spin at the crazy level that Big Brother does, and it's beyond spin, it's straight up fabrication. You need a populace that is too terrified to question you, too terrified to disagree, and also too stupid and just not engaged, doesn't care. And that's really what they need. They need people capable of doublethink. They need people speaking in a stupid newspeak language that robs them of the kind of vocabulary you would need for abstract thought or high-level thinking. And you need them reading stories with all sorts of evidence proving that whatever they said is actually true based on, you know, what, you know, based on the facts of the evidence of the history, that whatever. You need that to just as propaganda. Now, is the U.S. doing it more today than it did before? Are we moving more towards a government that is rewriting history? I would say no, because nobody really trusts the federal government anymore. We get our facts from sources that largely reinforce what we already believe. Republicans watch Fox News, Democrats watch MSNBC, or, I mean, whatever examples you want to give. There's this growing kind of feeling that we seek out information from sources that will just reinforce our current worldview and will not challenge us. That's the criticism of the news, the press, of the internet today, that we don't really want facts. We want spin. We want something that will feed us what we want to hear, whatever we were already thinking. So it just crystallizes what we already think. I think that's basically what we do. I don't think the federal government really rewrites history, because we don't really trust the federal government at all. And they don't have many opportunities to write history. History books are written by academics. And most people get their information from the internet anyway, which isn't the state. They get it from private sources, whether they're accurate or not, who knows. But so we don't really have that in America now. We do have like a bipolar news in this reporting of alternative facts, but not nearly. We don't really have this. This isn't really taking place in the United States today. It could, but it's something that, of all the things that I've, like the first few things I talked about, like I'm terrified because I see them. I see elements of 1984 happening in the U.S. right now and us moving in that direction. But in this one case, I don't think we are. This next one, we definitely are. And I call this kind of this section of what the party does, Panem et Circenses, or bread and circuses. The Roman Empire, in order to keep the people of Rome happy and content and not worried about the wars, the taxation, or the instability, the inequality, the bad government services, whatever, they would just throw on these circuses in the Colosseum to keep them distracted. These games, they'd give out free bread, hence the term Panem et Circenses, bread and circuses. Basically, entertainment and food and beer and wine to keep them satisfied, quiet, compliant, and just to shut them up. Big Brother does the same thing with porn. They have something called PornSec, which they just produce these smutty, stupid novels, you know, popular music that's just trite lyrics and nonsense, a lot of porn, and they give it to the proles to keep them content. And the proletariat or the proles represent like 80% of the people in Oceania. And they just figure, well, if we just give them food, entertainment, and porn, they'll shut up. Because they're idiots anyway, they'll never rise up, they're too distracted and too entertained. Wow. You could say that about a big chunk of Americans, maybe even a big chunk of people in the Western world. About 40% of Americans don't vote, ever. 40% don't give a shit. They'll complain. I'm sure a lot of them do complain about what's going on in the world, but they won't do anything about it. They don't vote. They don't. And about 90% of people do not give any money or spend any time for political causes of any kind. But we do consume a ton of fast food, a ton of beer and wine. We have problems with alcoholism, DUIs, public drunkenness. That's all. I mean, if you go to universities, the frat parties and all the things that go on at colleges, and colleges are supposed to be places of higher learning and culture and development, and they're basically glorified daycare centers for adults. We are obsessed. The popular culture is obsessed with consumption, with having fun. Watch enough commercials. You'll see that's exactly what every commercial ad wants you to do. They want you to be impulsive. They want you to be fickle. They want you to feel like your life is hard. No matter whatever's going on in your life, they want you to convince you that you have it a little tough and you deserve a break. Whether it's clothing, beer, food, trips, vacations, cars, jewelry, guns, whatever. I mean, they just want you to think that you need to consume. That they want a people that just consume. And the music's the same way. It's all about sex, largely. If you watch any music video, it's either explosions or sex or what. I mean, that's sex sells. I mean, that's the big thing in advertising and marketing. That's all they care about. They don't really care about what ideas these things are conveying, if any. They don't give a shit. All they care about is that you're buying. Beyonce doesn't really care that she has songs that, like two songs or three songs or lyrics that downright contradict one another, song to song, album to album. She doesn't care. She just wants you to buy the album. So when she does a music video on top of a police car in a flooded New Orleans city, or she wears that black uniform that is eerily similar to the Black Panthers uniform, which Michael Jackson wore 20 years before her, she doesn't care about the message. All she cares about is the attention and the sales. Jay-Z is the same way. Michael Jackson, same way. Lady Gaga, same way. There's all they care about is sales. They don't care about the ideas they're sending. In fact, they're glad with often to, if they are going to convey an idea, they'll convey a different idea every other month as long as they get attention and it somehow benefits their career. So tweeting something outrageous, wearing something outrageous, saying something outrageous, having a feud with another celebrity, having a feud with anything, doing something outrageous, celebrity breakups. I mean, it all helps them. It gets them attention, and any attention is good attention. All of this basically to say that our popular culture in America, because I can only really speak about this country. I haven't been out of the country in a while, so can't really speak about anywhere else. We already have a population of proles who all they do is, all they're interested in is consuming entertainment and beer and maybe pot. We know these people. We have them in our family. We know them as friends. We grew up with them. We went to school with them. Probably went to college with a few of them. And we work with a few of them. They exist. It's not everyone. It doesn't have to be everyone. That's the thing. You don't need to have 100% of the population all be proles. You can have 60, 70, 80%, or 40%, and you can probably achieve your objective if you're the government. We know these people. They're too distracted with themselves and with entertaining themselves and amusing themselves to care about anything else that's going on around them. They don't notice. A lot of people cannot name what countries that we have troops in, who we're at war with, where ISIS is, how many people have died, you know, in combat? You know, what battles are going on right now? They can't name who the Prime Minister of England is. They can barely, they know who the President is, but they can't name the Speaker. A lot of them can't name the Speaker of the House or a single justice on the Supreme Court. They don't know what the Citizens United case is. They don't know what Edward Snowden turned over about the NSA, and they don't care. I've hung out with them, and I don't know what the percentage is. It's a good number of people, but I've gone to parties with them. I've seen them. I've talked with them. They don't care. They don't want to give it any more thought because it takes away time they could be spending on their phone or talking about beer or talking about Dancing with the Stars. We have this in this country already, and we're doing it, and again, we are doing it to ourselves. These are private companies and private individuals doing this to other private individuals. That's what's going on. And there's no solution to it. We're doing it to ourselves, and the only way to do it is to stop, but I think we all know that's not going to happen. I mean, it's within our own power to stop consuming this garbage, but we won't. We never will. Maybe the number goes down, maybe instead of 30-40% or whatever the number, I mean, that's whatever the number is. I don't really care to give a guess, but the only real thing is to stop ostracizing, you know, the things that make us pay attention, you know, giving a shit about politics, you know, instead of referring to politics, you know, as always being something that is not worth your time. It's a big mess. They're all criminals. So why bother? If I were a tyrant, that's exactly what I want you to think. I don't want you to vote. I mean, if I were Big Brother, if I were the party, I want you to be proles. I don't want you involved. I don't want you to be active. I want you to not give a shit and to think, oh yeah, we're all corrupt. Fine, as long as you're not going to lift a finger to stop me in whatever I'm doing, I'm perfectly fine with that. If I'm a tyrant, that's why I think not voting is not a sign of any real. It's not sending a message to anyone. It's basically telling the government, you don't need to worry about me. I'm not going to be a problem. Do whatever you want. All right, I'm going to get down from my soapbox now. I apologize for the rant. That was probably too long, too excessive, and it's just that this book, it's been so influential. It means so much to me in terms of how I view the world, and it just so much of what is in this book I see happening in real life, and I see happening in the United States, in the country that I love, and it worries me, and it does worry a lot of people, and I understand I'm not the only one who's worried, and I'm not the only one who identifies these issues, but it's just that we recognize there might be a problem or that there is a problem, but we're not really willing to do anything about it. We elect the same people. We largely support most of these policies in the end, and we voluntarily give away our privacy to Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, Twitter, cell phones, text messaging. We're voluntarily doing it. We don't seem to have the same kind of views of right to privacy as a right that previous generations have or the founders did. We don't have concerns about civil liberties the way that previous generations have. And as technology and as our state grows more powerful, we seem to be less and less worried about it. Maybe it'll take a wake-up call of some kind, maybe some big story. I don't know. I thought the NSA thing would do it, but it just pushed the dial like a tiny bit. Maybe it'll take something bigger. Maybe it'll happen. Maybe our voting habits and everything will change to force, you know, the Congress and to force them to start respecting these things and respecting us as citizens. But as of now, I'm not optimistic. And that's really my conclusion here, is really that it's one thing to talk about it and kind of do some moral preening and put some things on Twitter and everything. But in the end, if you really want to make any kind of change happen, you're going to have to act differently. I mean, the first step for me, and I've already railed on this show earlier, is that we need to stop voluntarily handing this information out. The social media is one area, but I mean the Twitter, text messaging, all the information, all the apps we use, all the personal information we gladly give to third parties and to private companies. it's going to require us to give up some convenience. But I think all of us should be a lot more careful about how much of us we put out there. How much of yourself and how much privacy, you know, and actually maybe keep some privacy. Keep some things private. Don't share every fucking thing that comes into your mind. We just don't value it that much. We in fact think that everyone should share everything. I think we need to get away from that. Obviously, we need to vote a little bit more, and also stop voting the same fuckers in. In 2016, I think about out of the 400 some odd congressmen, I think 350 of them were incumbents. I mean, there was only like 50 or 60 new ones, which means like 80 to 90% of them got reelected. Congress has like the lowest approval rating you'll ever see, and yet 80 to 90% of them kept their jobs. And it happens every term because we don't change our voting habits. We're too polarized. We're partisan. We certainly don't think third party. About 93% of Americans voted for either Trump or Hillary, even though there seems to be this consensus that both candidates were garbage. But only 7% or 8% could bring themselves to vote for somebody else. And it goes all the way down the line. Everyone feels like we have to vote Republican or Democrat, or you should vote for the incumbent. You know, don't vote for the same lizard, because you don't want the wrong lizard to get in there, as the line goes from Hitchhiker's Guide. I mean, it sucks, but we have to give up some convenience, and we have to actually start standing up for ourselves. Otherwise, these technologies exist now that are in 1984. They exist. And in fact, they're more powerful than Orwell ever would have imagined. So we are capable of an Orwellian nightmare. And I think this book should make us start thinking of how to prevent it. Not just agree that we're at risk of it and that it might be coming, but I don't know, maybe try to act to prevent it. That's the thing that seems to be missing. We all kind of agree this is something that could happen. I mean, we all, you know, and just the total lack of regard for civil liberties, for right to privacy. We don't seem, or not right to privacy, but if you go through all the amendments, I don't know how often I've had conversations with people where they will make arguments against, or that say either an amendment, a constitutional amendment, a constitutional right should be pulled back, or in some cases outright eliminated. Whether it's First Amendment, Fourth, Fifth, Second, whatever. I mean, 4 through 8. I mean, I have heard people basically, they don't use the words, and they'll never say the words, but they seem to be okay with fascism. They hate the word fascism. They think fascism is evil, but they seem to support fascist policies. And until that changes, that's what worries me, that we seem to be okay with this stuff. As long as we don't use fascism, the word, we're okay with the actual policies and ideals, as long as we don't call it that. And we're okay with accusing each other of thought crimes, as long as we don't call it a thought crime, or thought police, or politically correct, or whatever. All right, I'm done. This is a long show. I probably should have warned that from the front. I was going to go on. I plan to go on and on this for a while. If you have not read 1984, go get it. Read it right now. Every human being should read this book. It is, to me, the best dystopian novel ever written, and it should. It's not a pleasant read. It's not a hero's journey. I'm going to leave it there. The next show will be on Ghost in the Shell. I'm going to go see it next weekend. No, it will be on Ghost in the Shell. I'm very psyched about this movie. I know there's a little bit of controversy heading in. I don't care. I can't wait to see this. I want to see how they did it and if they were able to stay true to the classic and how well they executed. I really want to see this. So that will be the next episode of Thought Crime. That will be next week. But for now, I will end it there. And until next time.